bark, 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 bark.
Somebody's wrong on the internet.
Bark for the stage.
Bark for the stage.
Just do the intro. Well, wait, you haven't got to do it, huh? Badoo.
All right.
You're on it.
This is a freedom week. Put on your Liberty jacket and prepare to look cool. Broadcasting for Podbay 2A, a mile above sea level, Intergalactic Prairie Studios. We alter your local stories by warming your synapses with regenerative radio waves. This warms your brain to a degrees Fahrenheit to keep a sin flood of statism out of your head. Can you feel, is it working, Michael and Nick? Can you feel it?
It's groovy. Yeah. I like it. It's warm and wet.
Can you feel it?
Like Biptunia.
Hashtag me too.
Yeah.
And the Freedom Fiends is covered by a BIPCOT no government license. This allows reuse by anyone except governments. Learn more at BIPCOT.org. Can you show us on the doll, Michael, where the government didn't touch you because you were covered by a BIPCOT no government license?
No, but I can expand on this Me Too thing. So for those who live in a cave that doesn't include internet access, even caves have internet access. Just ask Bin Laden. Ooh, you can't, because they killed him 15 years ago and then pretended to kill him 5 years ago. All right.
Allegedly.
So, allegedly. Yeah. I was going to talk about synthesizers, but I guess I'll talk about the time I was molested as a kid.
There's a difference.
Yeah, this is like turning into an episode of Oprah or something. So, wait, what? Synthesizers and molestation? Man, That's a bad dig on synthesizers. What do you got? Are you like the band Queen? Do you remember how they said no synthesizers on all their records that were great? And then they started to suck and they used a synthesizer on Another One Bites the Dust. Remember that?
And then they went back to their no synthesizer policy and stopped sucking.
Yep.
Well, Freddie Mercury
kept sucking. Man. It's all good. You know, he wasn't gay. He was bi. He liked all the flavors that life had to offer.
Yeah, that's called greedy.
Greedy. Man.
Or easy to please.
You want to save some of the dudes for you? You don't want him using them all up from beyond the grave? Damn!
That is not my concern. And I would never muscle it on your territory.
Yeah, so there's this hashtag. Well, first of all, a hashtag is something that's used on Twitter. Twitter is, I'm explaining this for the people on Grandpa's Internet, which is radio, because a lot of people in Wyoming, where I live, where we're on the radio, probably don't have internet. I'm kidding. So now they have to come into town to use internet. But so hashtag is a way of organizing common motifs, I guess, on Twitter. And there's a hashtag going around called Me Too, which is something you're supposed to post just by itself if you've ever been raped or molested. And I think then, like, it got so popular that some social justice warriors expanded it to include sexually harassed, which is like, I mean, I was sexually harassed yesterday by a doctor because I'm so good looking when he gave me my, I mean, I went into this room. My wife brought me to this place and she waited while a stranger drugged me and touched my butt and took pictures while strangers watched. It's called a colonoscopy.
And you didn't remember any of it.
And I didn't remember any of it. Yeah, because I was on the drug.
Jay calls it Saturday night.
Saturday night. And I was on the drug. They gave me the drug propofol that Michael Jackson died of, that he had to take because he had done so many horrible things in his life. He needed heavy sedatives to sleep. Allegedly.
Hey, he and Kmart both have little boys' pants half off.
Oh, man. We're the Freedom Fiends. Please rape and review. How do you know when it's time for bed at Michael Jackson's house?
When the big hand touches the little hand.
Oh, man. All right, so I'm going to get serious here and talk about how I was molested as a kid. We're not going to joke for a minute. Then we're going to go back to joking. And I'm going to name the guy who molested me. Which not many of these hashtag please feel sorry for me people. I don't want to say that. I people's feelings are their feelings, and if people want to gather together to commiserate and work through things, I'm fine with it. I celebrate it. I just don't celebrate all the communism that's attached to everything today. And, you know, there is a lot of victimhood. I had something weird happen tonight where, like, I was, I don't want to go there. It was something where, like, someone I knew died a long time ago, and someone else who knew that person who died didn't like that I was telling the story that the person had died, because people kind of attach ownership to people after they die. Have you noticed that? Like, even people they don't know, like, all of a sudden, like, everyone's a fan of David Bowie, you know? Where, like, I actually was a fan of David Bowie, and he, like, I wept more when David Bowie died than, like, when people I knew died. And same with Kurt Cobain. But I love Prince, but I didn't cry when he died. And, you know, I love Motorhead, and I didn't cry when Lemmy died. But, you know, people attach themselves. Like, all of a sudden, every hashtag is, Prince is my heart, you know? That kind of stuff. Like, and it's even worse when people know people or were there when they were killed or nearby when they were killed. Not worse, but just like people really attach ownership to things. And I say when somebody's dead and it's history, history belongs to everybody. You can't really own history. You know, you can't say to somebody, you weren't there when your best friend died, so can't talk about it. So anyway. So people like to put ownership on feelings, you know, and it seems like it's become a nation of, in a world of feelers. Like, people go to college not to learn science, technology, you know, engineering and math. They go to college to learn feeling. There's a funny thing in the show. Did you ever see the show Tremé? Really good show. Great show.
No, I've heard about it, but I haven't seen it.
Takes place in New Orleans. Just amazing show. You should watch it. Takes place in New Orleans after Katrina, and it's like a lot of different intersecting stories, a lot of musicians, and it's like it's got the best music of any show, and live best music of all kinds of music of any show I've ever seen, because it's New Orleans and it's music, and it's Tremé, which is pretty close to the neighborhood where I got mugged in New Orleans. Hashtag carry a gun. All right, so anyway. There's a scene in there where John Goodman plays a college professor in that, and he ends up killing himself. Oh, spoiler alert. He ends up killing himself by just, like, jumping off a riverboat when no one's looking. Because he's just so mad at, like, trying to, you know, basically get the government to fix New Orleans, which, and he's kind of a guy who's very, his character's very into, like, support, you know, taking care of yourself, but also, you know, there were a lot of things that the government takes money to do and then didn't do in that situation. And you know, there are a lot of things that they cut services for after Katrina. And one of them was, you know, college, Loyola College, where his character, who's based on a real person, teaches. And he's like, he's getting a list of stuff they're cutting. And they're like, you know, they're cutting English, you know, engineering, mathematics, and electronics and computer science and networking, and they're keeping, like, you know, African-American studies, women's studies, gender studies. And he's looking at this list, and he's like, okay, so you're cutting everything you need people to be able to do to rebuild after a hurricane. But boy, we'll know what our feelings are about it. And I kind of feel like that's where a lot of the world is. There's a cartoon I mentioned yesterday that I'll mention again, which is that really sums up feelings and people's feelings for me, which is, there's this cartoon that's like a city apartment building at night, and the windows are all open, and you can see in people's apartments, and they're typing on computers. They're all typing, like, I'm with her, or hashtag me too, or hashtag protect women, or hashtag bring our girls home. And outside the window, there's a woman in the alley with someone holding a knife to her throat, screaming for help. And they're all ignoring her and typing, like, take care of women, be strong for women. And I think there's a lot of that going on. I think that people think that a hashtag is activism. I think people think
that. Don't forget sending positive energy and vibes your way.
Oh, yeah. Which is the hippie way of saying prayers and thoughts and prayers. Yeah, people think that feelings are facts. So I kind of made fun last night a bunch of the Me Too hashtag, and I still will, but I'm going to put an asterisk of saying, you know, I'm not making fun of people who are molested. I think that it's a bad thing. Don't molest. And also, I would say, you know, women, like, carry guns, protect yourself, But don't shoot men just because they whistle at you. I see that is where feminism could go these days. But anyway, so the guy that molested me when I was 8 and he was 15 was my babysitter's brother, and his name was Victor Torres. Now, he's not, repeat, not the Victor Torres. It's a common name. He's not the Victor Torres that is my friend on Facebook. He's not the Victor Torres that is a well-known preacher that a documentary film was made about. But I can narrow it down to, and I can't even remember how Torres is spelled. It can be spelled different ways. But he is the Victor Torres that was 15 years old in 72. He was within a year, either way, of 15 in 1972. And he was the only Victor Torres who was a teenager at Westfield Academy and Republic School in Westfield, New York that year. Because I know this because they were the only Puerto Rican family in town. And everyone was like, it's the Puerto Rican family. But we were cool with the Puerto Rican family. They were his sister was my babysitter, his older sister. But he got me to perform oral sex on him. He performed oral sex on me. I really didn't want to do it. He didn't twist my arm, but he kind of guilted me into it. And then he gave me a tape recorder. Like, here's a gift, which I'm not going to say. And I'm not going to say what Ian Freeman says, which is, he had a similar situation, and the guy gave him an Xbox, but I think he wanted the Xbox. This was something that was given to me afterwards, like, here, don't talk about this. And Ian Freeman says that he was 8 years old or whatever, and he was somewhere around that age, maybe 10, alone. He said that he felt it was consensual. Kind of think that a kid that age isn't really old enough. He might have been a little older, I don't know, but I was not old enough to understand and consent. I will say that. F that guy. I hope he's dead. I hope he killed himself. But, you know, the tape recorder got me into good audio. So there's that. Hashtag bad audio is a hate crime. We out yet? No. All right. There we go. There we go. Awkward silence. Yep. And when we come back, I'm going to talk about something that was done to me that affected me a lot more and worse than what Victor Torres did to little me. Although that was bad. Hashtag me too.
You're listening to Freedom Fiends. So much truth, it hurts.
Are you tired of driving your kids to Gigi Allen's grave only to be unable to find the grave because some dick stole the headstone? Well, there is a solution. The Find Gigi Allen's Grave app for Android will give you door-to-grave directions. The Find Gigi Allen's Grave app uses advanced GPS protocols to guide you with voices to the exact patch of dust and grass where Gigi took his final dirt nap. Bring the kids. Do some needle drops at the Gigiest place on Earth. Gigi always had a huge underground following, but it's even bigger now that he's literally underground. So it's no surprise that lots of folks today take a pilgrimage to Gigi's grave. But getting there wasn't easy. Until this app. Forget Graceland, forget the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. Those are plastic places for old people with jobs. Hell, even CBGB's is gone, and that former hallowed ground is now a yuppie coffee bar. The real rock and roll Mecca is an unmarked patch of grass in Littleton, New Hampshire, and our free app will show you how to get there. Get the Find Gigi Allen's Grave app today. Even if you're not planning to go there soon, the app is fun. The Find Gigi Allen's Grave app is covered by the BIPCOT No Government License, and it's from the good people at Beast Lick Internet Policy Commission Outreach Team, who also brought you Fiend Phone, the Freedom Fiends radio app, BIPCOT, MeowBit, and of course, Truth, Justice, American Way. The Find Gigi Allen's Grave app is free. Get it today on the Google Play Store or on Amazon. Your family will thank you. And don't forget to rate and review. Worms, eating Gigi Allen's face.
Got it. I got it.
Do you really?
I do. I'm going to name some more people that abused me as a child by name. And, you know, if any of these people are like, that never happened. First of all, there's witnesses with these. Maybe not with the other kid. But any of these people, I'd be willing to stand up in open court and point at them and say, yes, this happened. I'd do it under oath. So there. So anyway, I went to Church Farm School when I was 14, this boarding school in Pennsylvania. Steve Miller knows where it is. It's up the street from him. He goes by it all the time. So I had an initiation there where these two kids, well, a bunch of kids surrounded me. It was kind of like Lord of the Flies. I'd been there about 2 weeks. And they screamed at me. They grabbed me and they hung me up on a hook on the wall, a coat hook by my belt loop. And they, you know, basically gave me a wedgie, or a nuclear wedgie, I think it is, where they hang you on a coat hook. And they did it to my other friend, my black friend, my one black friend, who, these kids didn't like us because we were like smoking pot and into weird music like Pink Floyd and Jimi Hendrix. And the one of these kids that did this to me, his favorite music was, Barry Manilow. This guy was a Barry Manilow fan. Yeah, it says all you need to know about him. So they hung me and this my friend Carl, who we called Jimmy because he looked like Jimi Hendrix, we thought, and he liked Jimi Hendrix, hung us on a hook on the wall, and he kind of squirmed off. He was stronger than me. He squirmed off and, like, ran away. And, you know, they're like five or six kids, you know, dogpiling on me and put me up on this hook and wouldn't let me down every time I tried. And I was screaming. And the housemaster, like the guy who ran the dorm, was in his room going like, oh, boys will be boys. Like, he heard all this going on, didn't do anything. And they were going to put snow down my pants. It was winter. They couldn't get the window open. So they said, let's put cold water down his pants. And they couldn't get it very cold. So they said, let's put hot water down his pants. The hot water was so hot at this place. There were two water heaters gagged together because there were, like, you know, all these kids taking showers at one time. But at this point, there were no one taking showers. So there was a lot of hot, very hot water. We used to soft boil eggs by running them under the sink. So they get a big cup of hot water. They pour it down the back of my pants. I scream and run off the hook, fall on the floor and run down the stairs and then fall. Secondary burns on my butt and ended up in the hospital for a week. Two kids got kicked out of school. Jim Skiles was one of their names, and the other was Patrick Donahue. Patrick Donahue got invited back the next year because he was a valedictorian and a letterman in three sports. That kid's probably running, you know, some government right now or some corporation, I'd bet. Some kid, you know, that's a captain of industry kid. Valedictorian, letterman, three letters in sports, you know, and picks on people. Like, that's a skull and bones kind of thing. Allegedly, so not only, like, these kids got kicked out, but I had to deal with one of them looking at, you know, like, being around me every day the next year. Till I got kicked out for calling the headmaster a fat, bald, overly Christian old fart. So Jim Skiles and Patrick Donahue from Church Farm School, I would have been class of 82. I hope you guys killed yourself too. So there you go. Freedom Fiends, rape and review. Please rape and review. All right, you guys go. What'd you do to Nick, Lou? This is all true. These guys are going to tell jokes now. What's your joke, Lou?
Oh, nothing. Yeah, he wasn't acting right, so he needed to be put in his place. Foolishness is bound in the heart of a young boy, but the rod of correction will drive it far from him.
Wow. What's that biblical craziness?
Well, he got mouthy, so he had to
get out. Is this true, Nick? Nick, speak up for yourself here. Protect yourself from these allegations.
I don't think I got mouthy.
Speak up. I can't hear you, Nick. Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
I'm laughing too hard. Yeah, I don't remember what I said. What I deserved, but
now I do know this: that there was a woman there that needs some help with getting her campsite set up, and she says, how much would you charge me to send Nick over there to do some work for me?" So I quoted a price, and we agreed upon it. I sent him over there, and I collected the money.
Wow. Yeah. So you pimped him out, basically. You rented him out. He's a rent boy. Nick's a rent boy.
I'm not saying that I pimped him out. I'm just saying that the area that he stayed in over by my camper was called the stable.
Wow. And he was 17 at the time. You're a bad man.
No, he was 18. He was 18 already. Yeah. And as a matter of fact, his resale value dropped drastically after he turned 18.
Yeah. All right, when we get back, I'm going to talk about Eurorax and why Keith Emerson blew his brains out from Emerson, Lake, and Palmer after this trip to the market.
I have something interesting, too.
You're listening to the Freedom Fiends, and I'm beaming these words into your cerebellum.
The Constitution well enough to know it's a well-crafted blueprint to create an ever-increasing federal empire. But there's still one thing missing.
Buttons!
Freedom Fiends now has buttons. You'll get state speech is hate speech, guns and weed,
buy sheep for sheep on sheep,
and Bitcoin, 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 Bitcoin.
Go to freedomfiends.com and click on the link at the top that says,
Fiend buttons are the thing for me. Some bigger than they used to be. Others once were big but now are small. If you're a real true fiend, gotta collect them all. Fiend buttons are the thing for me. Some bigger than they used to be. Others once were big but now are small. If you're a real true fiend, gotta collect them all. Fiend buttons are the thing for me. Some bigger than they used to be. Others once were big but now are small. If you're a real true fiend, gotta collect them all. Fiend buttons are the thing for me. Some bigger than they used to be. Others once were big but now are small. If you're a real true fiend, gotta collect them all. Fiend buttons are the thing for me. Some bigger than they used to be. Others once were big but now are small. If you're a real true fiend, gotta collect them all.
Yep.
Yeah.
All right. So
we have an important announcement.
Oh, go ahead.
Before you start talking about synthesizers.
Yep.
This is kind of a little bit of inside baseball for everybody here, so don't tell anybody. Well, you could tell everybody, but keep it on the down low. The 6th Annual Midwest Peace and Liberty Fest will be held from Thursday, June 21st through Monday, June 25th of 2018 at the Circle Pine Center in Delton, Michigan. There will be all kinds of tomfoolery and anarchy and bacon duels and
selling of dick.
Yeah. renting, buy, rent, lease, whatever, trade. So if you got something that I'm interested in, you can browse Bitcoin for a while.
How much Bitcoin? Yeah. For Nick's virginity.
I'm not really sure. And like I said, it's not even really a commodity anymore unless we can fake his birth certificate.
And wow.
Even the oil sheiks don't want him.
Wow.
I suppose if we put him in pigtails, we could do the Pippi Longstocking thing.
Oh, man. This is just depressing.
You've never seen Nick in person, have you? Yeah, he kind of looks like Carrot. Yeah, he kind of looks like Carrot Top before he got buff.
See pictures.
Yeah, he looks like Carrot Top before he started lifting.
Before he started lifting and got collagen injections into his face and lips and like implant cheekbones. Yeah.
Well, and he looked more manly after all the Michael Jacksonery. So, anyway.
I don't know, man. I think he looks like a drag queen now. I think he looked more manly when he was skinny.
Well, maybe he looks a little bit like a drag queen, but a masculine drag queen.
Before he got as thick as a bowl of oatmeal.
But anyway, so I guess we could pass Nick around until he gets buff.
Wow.
So, man. Anyway.
Synthesizers. So, Keith Emerson of Emerson, Lake & Palmer blew his brains out a few years ago, and I found this out recently, like this year, and I was sad because I really liked Emerson, Lake & Palmer when I was a kid. They were the reason I wanted to grow up and play synthesizers. He was flamboyant. He used to stab his keyboards on stage with Nazi knives, this article said, back when you could do that. There were other people who played a synthesizer on a record before him. The Beatles on like one song, and Simon and Garfunkel on one song, but he was the first guy to play, like, to really incorporate it in music as more than just a sound effect and to tour with them. And this is analog synthesizers back in the day before they were digital. Digital synthesizers now solve all the problems of analog synthesizers. They stay in tune. Analog synthesizers don't stay in tune. Analog synthesizers are very temperamental. They were extremely temperamental back then when he was playing them. They've got a little better, but analog synthesizers are still like, you have to let them warm up for 5 minutes before they're fully in tune, and half hour before they're really, really in tune. And then they go out of tune if you open the window because it's hot and cold air comes in. Whereas digital synthesizers or soft synths, which is what I use largely, are just perfect. They're in tune every time. They always sound great. They don't require a lot of tweaking. Soft synths are basically mostly samples of real synthesizers or sounds made on synthesizers or other instruments triggered, and yes, the word is triggered, by a MIDI keyboard. A MIDI keyboard is an inexpensive keyboard that doesn't make any sound on its own. Like, there's no way to plug headphones in or a speaker in and just listen to it. You have to plug it into a computer running a digital audio program that has MIDI samples in it, and it triggers them, like Cubase. You can record directly into the program from there. But you could download, like, you know, free synthesis in the 2 weeks that I've spent mucking around with analog synths, trying to get them to sound good and work in tune to play real music, you know, and spent like $700. Which is cheap compared to back when Keith Emerson was doing it. You know, in that time, like, I've downloaded like 5 new and digital synthesizer soft synths and made some great music with them. So really, at this point, I really feel that, like, analog synthesizers are fetishism. And there are people who say, oh, but they get thicker sound. No, they don't. You can get those thick sounds with soft synths anytime, and digital synths. And Keith Emerson still used analog synths, and I think that's why he blew his brains out, because he couldn't keep his synthesizers in tune, and after 45 years of doing it, it frustrated him so much he blew his brains out. Probably not. Actually, the reason he blew his brains out, allegedly, is that people were trolling him and saying that his music was no longer relevant, and he took it seriously. Man, that's time to get a new hobby, really, when people do that. Or, you know, you don't kill yourself over that. But all the people that, you know, pioneered analog synths, Gary Newman, Rick Wakeman, they're all using digital synths now in soft synthesizers because they don't want to spend 20 minutes tuning their synthesizer between every song live. So I've got some synthesizer equipment for sale. Anyway, so there's this configuration of modular analog synthesizers called Eurorack. And I dipped my toe into that. And I just got frustrated. And then, like, posted on this Eurorack forum, Muff Wiggler. Yeah, that's what it's called. Well, first of all, I posted on there that Greece was a failed state. And a bunch of socialists yelled at me for saying that Greece was a failed state, which is, like, mathematically, factually true. I mean, it's not subjective. And it's been around longer than America. America's a failed state, too, but Greece has been failing longer, so it's more failed. I ordered some synthesizer parts from Greece and ended up paying 45% tariff import, and I thought it was Greece, and I blamed Greece. And it turned out it was a failed state, but it was actually America charging me 45% tariff. Thanks, Trump.
Well, that's how you make America great again. See, America is a failed state, but Greece has been held back a couple of years.
But you can make it great again by making it impossible to trade with your neighbors. Yeah, right.
Well, how do you think you're going to build a successful economy without stifling trade?
Yeah, I'm not gonna rely on, you know, of all those, I'm gonna go to all those boutique Eurorack synthesizer makers in Wyoming. They're right in the back room of the gunsmiths. I'm kidding. there's the guy Barrasso, the congressman here from Wyoming that Steve Bannon's trying to run against right now, I think. You guys know about this?
Not really.
I'm glad. I think Bannon's funny, and, you know, if he wants to buy a mansion, mini mansion here, and then run for office and knock Barrasso out, I think it's funny, because Barrasso's one of those, like, I'm a small government Republican. He's always on Fox News. I think he has, like, you know, a camera and a green screen set up in his living room connected to Fox News. They have him on all the time as, like, their token Western state. He wears a cowboy hat and talks about economics. But he's also the guy who pushed to put a tax here in Wyoming on things bought on the internet, because he said that the internet was keeping people from going to brick and mortar stores in Wyoming. And I'm like, most of the stuff I buy online, you can't buy in a store in Wyoming. You can't buy MIDI controllers here. You can't buy, you know, the Micro Brute analog synthesizer here. You can't buy a Comrex here. So, yeah, he's dumb. He's dumb, and I hope he gets kicked out by Bannon.
And there's absolutely nothing wrong with people exercising an option to not go to a brick-and-mortar store.
Yeah, man, I know.
the world, the humanity has struggled for millions and millions of years to be able to get their stuff without having to go to a brick and mortar store.
It's kind of true in a way. I mean, that was never the goal. But, you know, ever since there's been commerce, people who sell things have been trying to make commerce easier and more lucrative to their customers, and governments have been trying to make it harder and take some of their money.
Yeah. And this whole fear of the internet is like being afraid of the Sears catalog. Did the Sears catalog end the brick and mortar store? No, it didn't. And the reason that people are going to continue.
But the internet ended Sears, is ending Sears eventually.
No, not really. Sears is probably ending Sears. They sold off the Craftsman brand a year or so ago. Matter of fact, I just had a conversation with a bunch of people on the interwebs about this. And Sears, the opinion, it's just anecdotal. It's the people that were on there. So the people that were commenting on there did not have a whole lot of nice things to say about Sears, as if it's not as good as it used to be. Which I can kind of see that.
Yeah, back when you could buy machine guns and opium through the mail for a dollar on the Sears catalog, and they deliver it by train.
Yeah, but the problem is Silent Cal or Do Nothing Calvin Coolidge. When he was president, the mail order, the gun sales, that was one of the very first prohibition-related gun control measures. So that happened under Do Nothing Cal. What else happened with him? Oh, yeah, the Fed charter was made permanent. So all you small government campaign for a tiny bit more liberty people that love Calvin Coolidge and hate the Fed, wow, that's part of his legacy. And what else happened? Oh, yeah, that's right. 1926 was when the roads got nationalized, and that's when the federal government started working on my roads again.
Yep. So in closing, analog synthesizers are coming up on having been commercially available for 50 years. That's 50 years right now.
Something that did not happen under Coolidge.
Don't buy them. You don't need them. Just buy Cubase or any of those other digital DAWs, digital audio workspaces, work programs, and get yourself a $100 MIDI controller and start making some beautiful music. You know, here's the thing. I checked out a lot of music by people who do this this Eurorack stuff, and most of it is not music. Most of it is, like, as my friend said, you know, people making digital fart sounds while they smoke dabs. And I really believe there's probably a bunch of people living in vans with a bunch of Eurorack equipment, homeless, you know, who aren't allowed to see their kids because they ran up the credit card and didn't pay child support and spent all the money on synthesizer modules. Because it's addictive and it's fetishist, and it's like people who do it, they're more into gear than music, man. Where it's, you know, I know there's people that spend $20,000 on this stuff and they can barely make a sound, and it just gives off heat and they make blip bloop noises. I mean, you know, Nine Inch Nails, Trent Reznor has a wall full of it, but he writes it off on his taxes and probably uses it to heat his studio. I've never seen him use it in any videos. In the winter, it just heats his studios with a wall of $100,000 worth of Eurorack. All right. Have a good show, guys. Me too.
You're listening to The Freedom Fiends, an invigorating alternative to those other shows.
Is your child defiant, independent, annoyingly inquisitive? After a long, hard day of following the rules, who wants to deal with troublesome kids? 49% of children suffer from oppositional defiant disorder, or ODD. Symptoms of ODD include independent thought, rampant creativity, and failure to submit to authority. But now there's a solution. The good people at Pilfer can help you with their time-release, once-daily capsule, Compliacin. Your child won't be able to form his own opinions, let alone express them. It maintains your child's ability to go to a state-run school and perform simple tasks around the house. You won't have to worry about parenting, and the school won't have to deal with your kid asking questions. Compliacin. You'll go from this.
Quit telling me what to do! Quit telling me what to do! Quit telling me what to do!
To this.
Good morning, Mother. I love going to school. And this week we're learning all about how the government is our federal family and they're here to help us.
Compliacin. Talk to your school psychiatrist and ask for it by name.
are back. Freedom Fiends. This is Lou, and I'm joined by Nick, and Michael has gone off to play with his furry synthesizer. So, we're going to change up now, and I'm going to start off with the promotion that I did for the show tonight, and it went like this. I expect to see an editorial in Salon any day now saying that the free market capitalism has failed in Venezuela and it's time for the government to finally take over the economy completely. Right now, it's October 2017, and we are at the 100-year anniversary of the Bolshevik Revolution, which brought about the Soviet Union. How much do you know about the Bolshevik Revolution, Nick?
I know a little bit about it, but not very much. I'm not very, not about the, yeah, I don't know much about the revolution itself.
Okay. The article that I'm going to read from is from FEE, Foundation for Economic Education. And it's written by Lawrence Reed. But what I'm going to start off with is not covered in the article here. And the 1917 was a pretty wild year in Russia at the time. Earlier in the year, I believe it was February, maybe March, probably February, was the what was called the Kerensky Revolution. I remember the first time I'd heard about it was reading something about Ayn Rand, and she was an actual supporter of the Kerensky Revolution, but she thought the Bolshevik Revolution was just absolutely horrible. The Kerensky Revolution is when the Tsars got taken out of power. And it was, how could I put it? It was kind of a popular uprising, and it wasn't a revolution in the normal sense of a bloody revolution. So you have Alexander Kerensky coming to power, and there were some changes that were going on. One of the big things that led to the downfall of Kerensky was that. Part of the reason that the Tsars were removed from power was because of World War I, and the Russian people were just really sick and tired of World War I. They had no business in that fight. Interestingly enough, World War I is a bunch of entangling alliances. Something that George Washington, I guess, spoke about in his farewell speech, when he warned to avoid these entangling alliances with foreign nations. And so you have all these different alliances that were going on, and that's how England got involved, because when the Germans went through Belgium to get to France, and interestingly enough, Germany had the alliance with the Austrian-Hungarian Empire, whatever it was. But anyway... Mm-hmm. Big giant cluster bleep of these entangling alliances. It reminds me of high school kids where one of them gets in a fight, or two of them get in a fight, and all their buddies go and jump in, and it turns into a big stupid rumble. But anyway, so the unhappiness of the Russians with World War I is what led to the Tsars being removed from power and the Kerensky Revolution coming about. Well, later on in the year... The Germans, in an attempt to cripple the Russians, because they saw that the Americans were coming into the war, and they had to do something to get the Russians out, because the Russians were over on the Eastern Front, they were battling the British and the French over on the Western Front, and the Americans were about to come in and make it a whole lot more difficult. So they had to find a way to reduce the fighting on the east so that they could shift troops over to the west. So the Germans grabbed Lenin. And, well, I don't want to say grabbed Lenin like they kidnapped him, but Vladimir Lenin was living in exile in Switzerland, and the Germans put him on a train back for Russia. And the joke, and both Dan Carlin and Prof. CJ talk about this, was it was a sealed car, and nobody knows if it was for Lenin's protection or for everybody else's protection, but they used Lenin kind of like a germ warfare with his communist ideas and sent him to Russia to infect Russia. And we'll talk about that a little bit more when we come back. We'll be right back.
Starving in the Company of Beautiful Women is Michael W. Dean's novel from the year 2000. It's entirely fiction.
Allegedly.
Starving in the Company of Beautiful Women is a glorious story about a low-rent, post-punk rock star, Cash Newman. Cash Newman is entirely made up.
Not a guarantee.
And is not based on any particular person.
Not a guarantee.
Cash Newman has lots of fun with strange ladies and with the party favors.
Don't try this at home.
And he hangs out with people who commit 3 felonies a page.
But that's none of my business.
It's all in good fun. And at the same time, it's kind of deep, but always spunky. Michael recently updated the book to a much better version. He released it as a paperback, and for the first time, on Kindle. As with this and all Freedom Fiends related things, please rate and review. And of course, it's covered by the BIPCOT NoGov license. Get Starving in the Company of Beautiful Women now on Amazon or at michaelwdean.com.
For entertainment purposes only.
This is the Freedom Fiends, broadcasting through the Libertarian Reeducation Center's Low Orbit Ion Cannon, high atop Financial Peace Plaza, on the artificial satellite Lid Pair 2017 in the Alpha Centauri region. The Freedom Fiends is covered by a BIPCOT no government license. This allows reuse by anyone except governments. Learn more at BIPCOT.org. So this is Lou, and I'm joined by young Nick Hazelton. Welcome back, Nick.
Hey.
Way to sound lively. You millennials are definitely not communicators. Put down your cell phone, look up at the microphone, and speak. Speak for the state.
I have my cell phone. I'm here looking at this article from fee.org. It's a long one and has a lot of Russian names. Let's skim through it.
Yes, it is pretty long. We're probably not going to cover the whole thing. Before we get started going back on that, I want to once again announce that the 6th Annual Midwest Peace and Liberty Fest will be held at the Circle Pine Center in Delton, Michigan, starting Thursday, June 21st, and going through Monday, June 25th of 2018. So, registration will be open for a little while, but get ready to round up your friends and family members and get them registered in the future. And bring bacon. Lots of bacon. So, back to this article from Fee. And once again, this is the 100th anniversary, the centennial of the Bolshevik Revolution in Russia, the former Soviet Union. And when we left off, we were talking about how Lenin was in exile in Switzerland, and the Germans put him on a train with the express purpose of him going back to Russia and just wreaking havoc and infecting people with his communism. They basically put Lenin on blankets and gave him to the natives. It was essentially what they did, because he was like a biological warfare, a biological weapon, or a germ warfare. And we see all these years later, this 100 years later, how this disease of communism had spread and how prolific it was and how many people died because of it. I'm not talking about, you know, socialized medicine, waiting times and stuff like that. I mean, I'm talking about murders and executions. I'm talking about forced starvation. I'm not talking about somebody got a wrong prescription or something like that, or they were out of a prescription. I mean, I'm talking about forced murders. So, yeah, just absolutely horrible. And it's really amazing that all these people are like, well, it just wasn't done properly. If only the right people were in charge. Anyway, this article from Lawrence Reed starts out, "The propaganda of the old Soviet Union referred to it for decades as the Great October Socialist Revolution, the momentous event that brought Vladimir Lenin to power and gave birth to 74 years of Communist Party rule. We are presently on the eve of its centennial." Do you know who Eugene Genovese is?
No, not at all.
Okay. The late Eugene Genovese is an American historian, and he was a committed socialist, very devout. As a matter of fact, he got involved with many of the socialist groups out there, and he got kicked out of many of them because those groups just weren't socialist enough for him. I mean, that's how extreme he was. And just a diehard socialist. And he later in his life, he had a conversion and converted to Christianity. And I don't know that they really renounced his Marxist views, but his description of the Soviet Union was nothing more than 74 years of failure and millions of murders. Now, this is a guy who was a lifelong supporter of this, or nearly a lifelong supporter, and that was his description. But anyway, Lawrence Reed, there's a picture of Lawrence Reed on the webpage, the guy who wrote iPencil. But anyway, he shares a little bit of his personal story. He says, I first became an activist for liberty 49 years ago in response to the Soviet invasion of Czechoslovakia. So in part for personal reasons, I could not let the centennial milestone pass without noting it in some way. The victims of the Soviet regime and other tyrannies has spawned in the 20th century approach 100 million in number. But can any article, book, or voluminous collection of both ever adequately do justice to the stories of the agony and sacrifice? Of course not. So with that limitation in mind, I choose to note the occasion by telling you a little about just two of those 100 million. Their names are Gareth Jones and Boris Kornfield. Are you familiar with Alexander Solzhenitsyn?
Yes, a little bit from, I've heard a little bit about his philosophy from Jordan Peterson.
Yeah, he wrote the book, The Gulag Archipelago, yes, talking about when he was locked up in the Gulag. And interestingly enough, I think his family wound up immigrating here to the U.S., and they had a place in Vermont. Now, they traveled around a bit, but very interesting in there. One of the most popular, most common quoted segments of that book was when he talks about, oh, but we burned in the camps. You know, but had we, I'm paraphrasing here, but had people taken up arms, had they grabbed a fireplace poker, a stick, whatever, and anytime the government agents came around to take people away, if they did not know for a fact that they would be coming home that night, would they still go out and do their jobs? And basically, he laments the fact that most people went to the camps without any form of resistance, without fighting it back. They were told to get on the cattle cars, and they got on the cattle cars. You know, they're basically, it's like, well, just do what you're told and file a complaint later. Or if you comply, you'll be okay. You know, that's a common refrain that hasn't gone away. But anyway, Gareth Richard Vaughan Jones was born in Wales on August 13th, 1905. Both his parents were middle-class educators, determined that their son would get the best education possible. By his 25th year, young Gareth had earned degrees in French, German, and Russian from the University of Wales and Trinity College at Cambridge University. Former British Prime Minister David Lloyd George hired him almost immediately as his foreign affairs advisor, a remarkable assignment for a 25-year-old. Gareth must have thought the world was his oyster. Little did he know he would soon be a celebrity journalist of international standing and dead before his 30th birthday. In the early 1930s, Jones undertook two fact-finding missions to Stalin's Soviet Union. He published several well-received articles in major Western newspapers about his observations. Before a third visit in March 1933, he picked up credible information that conditions in Ukraine, then one of the 15 Soviet republics, were dire. He resolved to find out for himself and scheduled a third mission for March 1933. A month before that fateful journey, Jones found himself invited by officials in Germany to cover a political rally in Frankfurt. Adolf Hitler had just been named Chancellor in January. 3 days before the February 27th burning of the Reichstag, Jones was one of the small handful of people on a plane bound for that rally with Adolf Hitler and Joseph Goebbels. As he witnessed the popular adulation of the man who would soon assume the mantle of Führer, Jones sensed the troubles ahead. If only the plane in which he flew with Hitler and Goebbels had crashed, he later wrote, the history of Europe would have been very different. Interestingly enough, it probably wouldn't have been much different. The fact that a Hitler could come to power wasn't because German people are evil or bad or anything like that. It's because the situation was just so absolutely horrible that people were desperate enough for anybody that came along promising hope and change that for them to embrace it. And that's what he did. He was a populist. He was a populist like Obama was in 2008 and Trump was in 2016. So it's no difference. You know, if that plane had gone down, then Hitler and Goebbels would have been replaced by another version of Hitler and Goebbels. And even worse, it might be somebody more competent than Hitler. And Hitler was not competent. We know this because the Allies quit trying to assassinate him and his own people started trying to.
Yeah.
But anyway, with his assignment in Germany behind him, Jones arrived in Moscow in March. Travel from there to Ukraine was forbidden. But that didn't prevent him from eluding Soviet authorities and making his way there anyway. What he saw and heard horrified him. By the end of the month, he was back in Berlin and reporting to the world. In an article published in the New York Evening Post, Britain's Manchester Guardian, and many other papers, he wrote, "I walked along through villages and 12 collective farms. Everywhere was the cry, 'There is no bread. We are dying.' I trampled through the Black Earth region because that was once the richest farmland and because the correspondents had been forbidden to go there to see for themselves what is happening. In the train, a communist denied to me that there was a famine. I flung a crust of bread, which I had been eating from my own supply, into a spittoon. A peasant fellow passenger fished it out and ravenously ate it. I threw an orange peel into the spittoon, and the peasant again grabbed it and devoured it. The communist subsided. I stayed overnight in a village where there used to be 200 oxen and where there now are 6. The peasants were eating the cattle fodder and had only a month's supply left. They told me that many had already died of hunger. 2 soldiers came to arrest a thief. They warned me against travel by night as there were too many starving, desperate men. 'We are waiting for death,' was my welcome. Go farther south. They have nothing. Or there they have nothing. Many houses are empty of people and already dead,' they cried." Ukraine was always considered the breadbasket of Europe because of the fertile soil. And that's where a lot of the grains and everything else were grown. And the Ukraine was supposed to feed the entire Soviet Union. But because of these mass starvations, what had happened there was Stalin had ordered all the produce to be confiscated, and the people that were growing it were left with nothing, and they starved to death.
Yeah, you can't kill off the people that are feeding you, right? You can't take away their food.
doesn't
make any sense.
I mean, it's absolutely amazing, the way that they were doing things, and I don't know if I could call it foolishness or a belief that they could just make crazy orders and declarations and be completely immune to the consequences of it.
Yeah. Yeah.
So
that's communism.
But anyway, more of that when we come back.
Arms.
Freedom Fiends with Michael Dean. This is what radio sounds like now. Cell 411 is a free app for Android and iOS that replaces government-controlled 911. Cell 411 allows you to preset a group of friends or private organizations to show up in any emergency. Cell 411 is a nightmare for the state because it proves their so-called services aren't needed. Cell 411 has had thousands of installs, and of course it's covered by the BIPCOT No Government License. Cell 411 because your friends won't shoot you when you're in trouble. Without the government, who would build the emergency services? You and Cell 411. Get it today at GetCell411.com. That's GetCell411.com.
Was that a meow? No, that was a baby yak growl. So anyway, we are back, and we are talking about the centennial of the Bolshevik Revolution and the disease of communism, or state socialism, more accurately, that spread from it. So Nick's going to jump in and do some of the reading for a bit. And so take it away, Nick.
Yeah. Jones had walked into one of the, this is, well, I forget his whole name. It's like Gareth Richard Vaughn Jones. This is who we're talking about. He's a journalist, but wasn't he also the British?
I think he was working as an advisor. I think he was working as a journalist at the time, not in that other position. But anyway.
All right. Well, anyway, Jones had walked into one of the great October Socialist Revolution's most heinous crimes, the Holodomor of 1932-33, known also as the Terror Famine and the Ukrainian Genocide. It was an intentional man-made plan from the top catastrophe that claimed the lives of between 4 and 10 million people. From Stalin on down, communist officialdom engineered it to crush Ukrainian resistance to the forced collectivization of agriculture. Two years and millions of deaths later, Stalin would declare in a speech, "Life has improved, comrades. Life has become more joyous." In Bloodlands, Europe Between Hitler and Stalin, this is a book, I guess, historian Timothy Snyder refers to the widespread cannibalism during this disaster. Survival was a moral as well as a physical struggle. A woman doctor wrote to a friend in June 1933 that she had not yet become a cannibal, but was not sure that I shall not be one by the time my letter reaches you. The good people died first. Those who refused to steal or to prostitute themselves died. Those who gave food to others died. Those who refused to eat corpses died. Those who refused to kill their fellow man died. Parents who resisted cannibalism died before their children did. That's pretty brutal.
Even here in America, even the poorest people can go. I don't know anybody in America, or I don't even know of anybody in America that is so desperate for food, that has such a lack of ability to obtain food, that they're considering eating their family members or their neighbors or any other human being. The gravity of this, it's just unbelievable to even consider it. We're not even talking about some crazy tribe down in the Amazon that has weird rituals. We're not even talking about trying to make the sun rise the next morning. You know, we're talking about people that are contemplating this for survival, for their very existence, in the breadbasket of all places.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
Continue.
Okay. Let's look here. Yeah. 27-year-old Gareth Jones was the first journalist to ever reveal the infamous Ukrainian famine to the outside world. No credible person today denies that it occurred, but in March 1933, Jones was shocked to find his revelations met with denunciation from some veteran and highly respected journalists. Chief among the deniers was reporter and Soviet sympathizer Walter Duranty, of the New York Times. On March 31st, Duranty penned a piece for the Times in which he claimed Jones' report to be a fabrication. He even cited Kremlin sources, as if they were to be trusted, who labeled Jones a flat-out liar. Duranty never apologized for his allegations against Jones, nor did he ever retract his there-is-no-famine propaganda. He would later win a Pulitzer Prize for his coverage of the Soviet Union. Decades later, the Times conceded that his articles amounted to some of the worst reporting to appear in this newspaper. Duranty was a classic example of what Vladimir Lenin disdainfully labeled useful idiots. They're still around, by the way, in disturbing abundance. You can learn more about them in the works of sociologist. That's going to be way easier than I make it. Paul Hallander, and
It's really interesting because when you hear all these, there was a lot of Soviet sympathizers in the media, and I remember hearing stories about a bunch of them going over to the Soviet Union, and they may have been in Moscow or one of the other larger cities, and they were amazed at the great equipment that they had there, the printing presses for the newspapers, and they'd go over to the back and would say, "Made in New York City." and they're so proud of the Soviet accomplishment. We'll be back.
Listening to Freedom Fiends with Michael Dean and some of his weird friends. And yes, we're broadcasting this into space.
When you shop online, please do it through the Freedom Fiends Amazon link over on the right side of freedomfiends.com. It won't cost you any extra, and the fiends will get a little taste from Amazon, and Amazon will save you the danger of drive-by stabbings at your local mall. Amazon sells pretty much everything you can buy on this earth, except for guns and weed. But they do sell the DVD Guns and Weed, The Road to Freedom. So get that for your gun-hating stoner brother or neocon gun nut dad. They'll thank you for it. That's freedomfiends.com. Freedom, Foxtrot, Echo, Echo, November, Sierra.com.
And go on the sidebar of the Freedom Fiend site. We now have Amazon links for Amazon US, Amazon UK, and Amazon Canada due to popular demand. Worms.
This is Lou, and I'm joined by Nick, and we are talking about the 100-year anniversary of the Bolshevik Revolution and the millions of murders that occurred because of it. Something else that the reporters would talk about, because many of them, as we discussed, were Soviet sympathizers, they would say that the people are suffering, but they're suffering nobly. As if there's a nobility to starvation. But, really crazy. As a matter of fact, I think you were on with, I think it was you, me, and Diana that were talking about this just a couple of weeks ago with Venezuela. Because what was the article? Is socialism, not oil, that caused things to fail in Venezuela. But anyway, going back to the article here, Moscow despised the fact that Jones had found a way to get into Ukraine against its wishes. Telling the world about conditions there put him on the official blacklist. Soviet Foreign Minister Maxim Litvinov, whom Jones had interviewed in Moscow, wrote a personal letter to Lloyd George informing him that his colleague Jones would never be allowed entry into the Soviet Union again. Wow, that's like getting kicked out of the White House press room for negative reporting. Oh, wait. Yeah. 2 years later, Jones and German journalists covered events in turbulent China. They were captured by bandits who released the German within 2 days but held on to Jones for 16 more. Then, under mysterious circumstances, on August 12th, 1935, the day before his 30th birthday, Jones was shot to death. As a BBC documentary suggests, the evidence tying the murder to the Soviet secret police is very strong. 2 weeks after Jones's killing, David Lloyd George paid tribute to his young friend. That part of the world is a cauldron of conflicting intrigue, and one or other interests concerned probably knew that Mr. Gareth Jones knew too much of what was going on. He had a passion for finding out what was happening in foreign lands, wherever there was trouble, and in pursuit of his investigations, he shrank from no risk. I had always been afraid that he would take one risk too many. Nothing escaped his observation, and he allowed no obstacle to turn from his course when he thought that there was some fact which he could obtain. He had the almost unfailing knack of getting at things that mattered. Gareth Jones didn't live to see his courageous reporting vindicated, but his memory is celebrated today in Ukraine, where he was a national hero. And imagine that. Imagine I really don't even know how to put it. And it's really amazing, because I've read about things like this so many times, but when I was younger, it was never real. It was some abstract sort of thing that maybe I couldn't appreciate or maybe I couldn't accept. I don't know what it was that it wasn't as real as it is today, or even in recent past. And I remember East Germany. I was stationed in West Germany when the Berlin Wall came down. I remember the Cold War. I remember state socialism. I remember talking to East Germans that had escaped. And it's amazing when people talk about escaping their country. I never would have imagined, why would you try to escape your country? I mean, isn't your country, you know, our country, isn't this great thing that we should love and respect and not want to leave? But it turns out that it's really not like that. Yeah. So it's just really, really amazing and shocking. And when I think about the Soviet government, the fact that they're trying to cover this stuff up, okay, I can see that they want to prevent negative press from getting out there. I don't want to say that they want to stifle the truth, but it's they want to keep the negativity out of the public eye. And I really have to wonder what it is that are they so wedded to this ideology of state socialism that they will ignore anything that's going on, or is it a matter of they just want to be in control and to rule these people mercilessly, that they don't care, they just want to cover up the crimes? Or is it somewhere in between? I really don't know, but it's just absolutely baffling that if, you know, let's just say for a minute that maybe the communists, they actually did want to create the workers' paradise and they did want the people to be better off. I don't buy that for a minute because politicians are control freaks. But let's say that they just did, that they did want that. How on earth could they continue with their course of action that keeps bringing failure, that keeps bringing death and murder and starvation and everything else? How could they keep up with this and not change course?
Yeah, it seems like, I don't know, it's pretty evident when your idea isn't working, when you have people starving, right? I don't know what kind of evidence they were waiting for to, you know. I that's what I don't really get about people who still favor communism, especially state communism, state socialism, is we've tried it before. I shouldn't say we. I haven't tried it before, but it's been tried before by plenty of people, and there are millions and millions of people who can't attest to how bad it is because they died because of it. And I don't know. Say what you want about wage slavery, but capitalism doesn't kill that many.
Is it a wage or is it a slavery? Pick one.
Yeah, exactly.
That's one of the things that Lysander Spooner said that I really strongly disagree with. This wage slavery, it's just nonsense. It's hyperbolic nonsense. But it's...
Yeah.
So... actually, the U.S. did have an experimentation with state socialism, and never went to full state socialism, but it was during World War II. And what I mean by state socialism is the economy was darn near completely nationalized in many regards. Things were rationed. So it's really amazing that people will talk about the New Deal got us out of the Great Depression. The Democrats will say that because, you know, they think the welfare programs helped out. And then the conservatives will say World War II got us out of it because of militarism. But to be honest with you, if one was going to get the U.S. out of the Great Depression, then the other one would have also, because ultimately they were the same thing. What you had was darn near a complete takeover of the economy by the U.S. federal government. You had diversion of resources. For example, it was in 1943, Ford Motor Company did not make a single vehicle for civilian use, for non-military use. Is that the sign of a good economy, that you're not producing things for the public to buy? No, it isn't. And in comparison, under the New Deal, they were taking food and destroying it. The 6 million pigs that were slaughtered to keep the prices up to the pig farmer. The acres and acres of cotton and other agriculture that were destroyed, that were burned to keep the prices high. And as a side note, originally they weren't going to burn the crops in the field. They were going to have the mules pull the plows through there and just plow everything under, but the mules have been trained to go in between the rows of crops and not through the rows of crops. So it turns out that the jackasses in the field were smarter than the jackasses in Washington, D.C. But during World War II, food was rationed, fuel was rationed, everything was rationed. Everybody had to go without, and that was just a brush with state socialism. So you had shortages, you had people going without, you had people that couldn't get different things, and another argument against World War II being the great savior in the ending of the Great Depression. You do not make a strong economy by taking the young and fit men out of the factories and replacing them with their wives, children, and grandparents. That's not where productivity comes from. You don't take the best and brightest and send them off to be killed or crippled to a tune of 1.1 million killed and wounded. You don't kill your customers to create a better economy or your workers. So no, World War II did not end the Great Depression. And that was a brush with socialism. Millions of dead and plenty going without.
Yep.
No response.
I mean, it just happens over and over again. It's, yeah, I don't know what it is. What does it take to get people to realize, like, you got to take them out of their academic ivory towers and show them, like, hey, this is how the economy actually works. You show them, you know, the people who work in the factories, the farmers who do plow the land. This is how it works. It's all work. And what you do is it's nothing compared to them. You teach people about stupid ideas and, yeah, it takes a lot more than thinking, you know. That's to me, this is where it comes down to, is it's people who think they know better than everybody else. It's a few people who have decided, hey, I've come up with an idea about how the world should work. Let's change everything about the world and do it the way I've came up with, as if the world hasn't existed for hundreds of thousands of years before you. You know, it just doesn't make sense. I don't know. Why would you still believe in communism after all of that?
I have absolutely no idea. I think I've told the story a couple times, but there's a guy I knew. He grew up in Estonia, and he, after the Soviet Union collapsed, he quickly moved to Austria, and he was there for a little while, and then he came here to the U.S., and he's been living here for quite some time. You may have met him at Liberty Fest last year, but anyway... He tells a story about growing up in the Soviet Union and everything else. And he says, you know, I never met anybody that believed socialism could work until I came to America. And yeah. it was a fact that he had lived under it. And these people have this wide-eyed dreamer ideological nonsense about them of, oh, we can make this perfect utopian world where everybody shares and where everybody has enough and all sorts of stuff. And quite frankly, if state socialism or communism could deliver upon the promises that it makes, I probably might even buy into it, because I consider those to be nice things. I consider those to be noble goals, but it can't. So I don't buy into it, because the only thing they can bring is millions and millions of murders and failure and starvation.
Yep.
So, yeah, it's, and quite frankly, I don't know if they're getting this nonsense at such an early age in the government indoctrination gulags, and quite frankly, the government schools, and they teach socialism, I don't know if they're just getting it too early, or if this is something that people are going to cling to. I don't know. We'll be back.
You and the hamster in your brain are listening to Freedom Fiends with Michael Dean and his weird friends. Biptunia, music for the drive to Alpha Centauri. Biptunia's influences are Gary Numan, Brian Eno, Pink Floyd, David Bowie, Led Zeppelin, Grateful Dead, Frank Zappa, Robert Fripp, Blondie, Kraftwerk, and Dead Kennedys. Biptunia styles are trip-hop, rock, pop, glam, industrial, ambient, jazz, and space. Plus, it's got cats and is covered by the BIPCOT NoGov license. You can download Biptunia's music free. Go to biptunia.com. That's BIPTUNIA. Bravo, India, Papa, Tango, Uniform, November, India, Alpha, biptunia.com.
Freedom Fiends. Redemption in the Third Act. What do you got, Nick? You got anything?
I was just going to say that one of the things I think I miss most about being on The Fiends this summer was the bumper music. I really enjoy the bumper music.
I think on MichaelWDean.com, he has his entire archive of music that he's created on there. And people could go on there and download it at no cost. And you can get all the bumper music, not to mention his stuff with Bomb and Slish and Beefeater or whatever it was. But
yeah. I've enjoyed going through Bomb and Slish. I don't think
Right Arm of Wyoming.
Yes, that's a great one. I think I shared one of his videos recently with somebody. Somebody was asking for I can't remember. They asked for something specific about an artist that was into libertarianism or something like that. That was back when Stady though.
Hmm.
Wasn't it? That was back when he wasn't quite ANCAP. He was
a newly minted minarchist or min statist. He had that new min statist smell to him even. Yeah. So I do have some Redemption of the Third Act since we've been talking about communism for the past hour and a half.
Yeah.
Finally, there's an anti-drug program, and it's actually being successful. New anti-drug program teaches teens to resist psychiatrists' constant pressure to use drugs. From Alexandria, Virginia. As a part of an effort to provide young people with the tools necessary to make responsible decisions, a coalition of the nation's leading anti-drug activists launched a new initiative Tuesday with the goal of teaching teenagers to resist pressure from psychiatrists to use drugs. A lot of teens just don't know how to say no when drugs are constantly pushed on them by mental health professionals, and we aim to remedy that, campaign director Karen Thorpe said of the initiative, which will implement programs at high schools and middle schools nationwide in which 13 to 18-year-olds can discuss times they have felt coerced into trying controlled substances during therapy sessions. It will provide them with methods to avoid the influence and persuasive tactics of drug-pushing psychiatrists. These kids see their friends and classmates using drugs in middle school or even elementary school, and they start to think it's normal. We have to break that cycle. These kids need to know that just because a person pressuring them to use drugs is older than they are and uses forceful language, that does not mean using drugs is a good idea. While Thorpe said the program is a great start, she noted that the systemic problem couldn't be fully addressed until the government shows the will to take on the handful of large, powerful groups that are behind the drugs production and distribution. And that article is from The Onion, believe it or not.
I loved that when I saw it. I actually didn't look at the website or the URL before I read this, and I was reading it, I thought, man, this is a weird article, but I kind of got it was a joke probably halfway through. I was like, really? But that was so funny. I couldn't believe I didn't look at it. Oh, yeah.
Yeah, it's really interesting, the number of kids they're taking drugs these days, and this whole ADHD and ADD and all this other stuff and this acting out. It's really kind of crazy. I was talking to a guy I know. I was talking to his son who's, I think, a fifth or sixth grader, and they don't have recess anymore.
Oh, no.
And the whole thing about being that age is, and you're full of energy, and you know, and you were that age mm-hmm. just like a couple months ago, darn near. And... But the thing is, these kids are full of energy, and they need to go out, and they need to play kickball and dodgeball. Well, you're not allowed to play any of those anymore. But they need to get out there and burn off some of this energy, and that's how they'll be able to concentrate when they go back into the classroom. But maybe it's better that they don't concentrate, because maybe then they won't be learning to love socialism so much. Maybe they'll be so wired up that they'll just, like, not pay attention to the indoctrination.
Yeah.
Any final words?
Free the kids. Drop out. School sucks.
All right. Thanks for coming on the show tonight, Nick. And thanks to everybody for listening. For more Freedom Fiends, go to freedomfiends.com.
worms.